Welcome to a podcast brought to you by the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Our academy is a national organization committed to excellence in orthopedic manual physical therapy practice, education, and research. And we're here to explore a wide range of topics with you through interviews with content experts.
Hello. My name is Stephen Schaefer, and I'm one of the co-hosts of the AAMPT podcast. I'm thrilled to bring you our final interview from the 2020 annual conference. Our guests today are Drs. Evan Peterson and Stephanie Thurmond. Dr. Peterson is a tenured associate professor at the University of the Incarnate Word School of Physical Therapy, where he teaches courses in patient management and clinical reasoning. Prior to his appointment at UIW, he was the graduate program director of the Army-Baylor University Doctoral Fellowship in Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapy. He is both a board-certified clinical specialist in orthopedics and a fellow of our academy. Dr. Stephanie Thurmond is an associate professor at Bowling Green State University School of Physical Therapy. As the program director, she is currently working to develop a new Doctor of Physical Therapy program at BGSU. However, she first entered academia back in 2013 after spending the first part of her career as a clinician in outpatient orthopedics. We invited Drs. Thurmond and Peterson to the podcast because they were presenters at this year's Academy Conference. Their presentation was titled Systematic Clinical Reasoning, From Novice to Expert in No Time. Of note, you're going to hear us refer back to a prior 2018 conference interview that also dealt with the topic of clinical reasoning. I want to tell you that while both Dr. Peterson and Dr. Thurmond were co-presenters of that breakout session, only Dr. Peterson joined the podcast back in 2018. He was certainly a phenomenal guest, but this time around, we're grateful to have both of these wonderful presenters on the podcast. Speaking of which, I'm excited to see what both of these seasoned clinicians and academicians have to share with us today. So let's get to the interview. Dr. Thurmond, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, we are excited to have you here, that's for sure. And in the case of Dr. Peterson, I'm going to say welcome back to the podcast. How are you?
I am doing well as well. Thank you very much, Stephen. It's great to be back. I love the AAMPT podcast, and it's a privilege to be invited back to talk a little bit more about the things that we love and are passionate about.
Again, it's great to have you here. And just for the audience's sake, I'll say that you were here originally on episode number 12, which was, I believe, about 2 years ago. So we've been at this a little bit longer. And I would encourage all of our guests to go back and listen to that episode 12 because it is related to the topic we're going to talk about today. The title of your presentation at the 2018 conference was Putting Your Clinical Reasoning in Order: Effective Teaching and Learning Strategies for Physical Therapy Students and Educators. Here we are 2 years later with a 2020 conference, and we'll try to make it sound logical and have it flow well, but just so the audience knows, we are in a weird timeline of events here. You've already recorded the presentation because we're having a virtual conference. However, that recording has not yet played because the conference hasn't occurred, which means we're interviewing you before the conference. So it's kind of an interesting scenario, but I guess we'll just call that 2020, right?
That sounds great.
So as we dive in today, what I want to start with is one of those background questions. And I know in your presentation that you referred to the fact that you're both passionate about clinical reasoning. I would like to know, why is that the case? What makes you so passionate about the topic?
Well, Stephen, I started out in the clinical setting, of course, before I went to academics. And as a CI, I saw firsthand the errors that occur when students don't have a way to systematically evaluate their patients. So they would come in with a good understanding of anatomy and physiology and tests and measures, but they had a lot of difficulty putting all of that together. And I just saw that over and over again. So one thing that we really are passionate about is that clinical reasoning is at the core of clinical practice. And so if we don't do this very well, then all other aspects of clinical practice really suffer from that. And so even though this is a complex process, a complex skill, in my opinion, it's really a foundational skill for all health professionals, just like understanding anatomy is.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more on that. And I have personally seen, when I say personally here, I mean professionally as well, how learning that clinical reasoning process, that whole cognitive component of the profession, how it made me into a vastly better physical therapist. And I've seen people complain about it initially, you know, why are we talking so much about how we think and how we make decisions? But usually in most cases, when I'm mentoring somebody or when I've been mentored myself, we get back to that topic as we go through the education process further. And most folks look back and say, hey, that was really helpful. Learning how to think made me a better clinician.
I couldn't agree more with what you both said. You know, I've had the privilege of teaching at the entry level, residency level, and fellowship level education. And so I've had the opportunity to see learners at each of those stages, and what they are doing is essentially clinical reasoning at all of those things. The entire clinical encounter is really clinical reasoning. You're deciding what to do, when, and why. What's interesting, though, is some of these errors in clinical reasoning that we identified back in the AM podcast a couple years ago continue to be present, not only in entry level, but as Stephanie and I serve as CIs or in the clinic, we're seeing these with even more experienced clinicians. And so our passion really comes from trying to eliminate these things. Is there a way we can better teach clinical reasoning to eliminate or minimize these clinical reasoning errors that we make at whatever level of education we're at? And then really the last thing is just the joy I think that both of us have in seeing the learner grow, especially at the, when I moved from a fellowship level education to entry level, it was a big transition for me because the thinking is a little different. The speed at which the thought process happens is a little bit slower, which is understandable. But what I loved about it was the same joy that comes across a student's face when all of a sudden the light bulbs come on, they make the connections, and all of a sudden a clinical encounter goes well. And that's why I'm passionate about clinical reasoning, about teaching, is to see that process of growth that our students go from, going from that novice level through the advanced beginner, competence level, proficient level, and then on to the expert level practitioner.
As we move forward, I want to bring up just momentarily that I saw in your presentation that you're working on a paper. I think the working title at this point is Severity, Irritability, Nature, Stage, Stability, or SINS, a clinical reasoning construct for effective patient clinical management. Can you talk to us a little bit about this paper that's in the works and maybe when we can expect to see it being published?
Absolutely. Thank you, Stephen. Stephanie, I, along with Gail Jensen at Creighton University, have written a clinical commentary about the SINS construct. Now, this is a construct that appears in several textbooks and some peer-reviewed literature, but it's really been inconsistently defined and applied. And as we have seen, I was first introduced to it as a clinician in my fellowship level training, and it resonated with me so much that I started to introduce it more at the entry level. And what we're finding now that we're teaching at the entry level is how effective this construct can be of really helping the student understand the patient better. It really brings the context of the patient and their problem to the forefront, and it forces the clinician really to participate in really effective data gathering and management. Because if you don't do this, it's very difficult to understand the patient. So we talked just very briefly about this, I think, at the 2018 AM conference. And based on feedback that we got from that conference, Stephanie and I started to talk a little bit more about this construct, how we use it. And that was really the creation of our idea of, well, why don't we write this up? Because as we did the literature review on the SINS construct, it was kind of here and there in this textbook and that textbook, but the textbook weren't saying exactly the same thing all the time. And it really wasn't being applied in a clinical reasoning manner. And so that's really the purpose of our paper, is we present the SINS concept much more detailed. We present it in a way that's truly clinical reasoning focused, and we show how it's starting to help our students and future clinicians minimize diagnostic, prognostic, and interventional clinical reasoning errors. We have finished the manuscript. It's been submitted for publication, and we hope to have it published soon. So once that is, we'll be happy to talk about it, hopefully at a future conference.
I can always go back and update the show notes. So whether that's published in a week, a month, or 6 months, we can just slide that link in so our audience can always go back and find it.
Perfect.
As we dive in a little bit deeper, I'd like to talk about the differences in how a novice clinician uses their clinical reasoning compared to a more expert clinician. Can you give us a little bit of an explanation on how they might vary, which of course could then maybe teach us how we can take the novice clinician and then move them towards thinking more like an expert?
Absolutely, Stephen. You know, this is a part of our presentation that we go to in quite in depth. The more you understand about what a novice is and what a novice does, I think you'll start to realize how important it is that these very systematic, structured processes that we've tried to put in place is helping them advance more quickly from that novice to the expert type of practitioner. And again, this is the impetus of our presentation and how it differs from the one that we did back in 2018. We tried to really go into depth in some of these strategies and show, can we move the learner more quickly from that novice level into the competence level much faster than having them wait till they get to their fellowship level or residency and fellowship level training to start to learn to really think. And this is why, Stephanie, I feel very passionate about this. Some of the key aspects of a novice, a clinical reasoner, is they really participate in more of a backward reasoning or hypothetical deductive reasoning. And this is not necessarily bad. In fact, we want our novice learners to spend more time in this type of thing because they really don't have the knowledge base to inform their decision-making. So that will come with time. But what's interesting as you start to really look at the literature on novice learners, specifically with the clinical encounter, they actually spend less time with their patients overall. And whether that's out of fear, out of lack of knowledge, or whatever, that clinician encounter, that time with the patient is much less than what an expert normally does. And what's interesting as you dive a little deeper, they actually spend more time on the objective exam or the tests and measures portion than they do on the actual interview. And this would make sense a little bit because of the lack of knowledge that they have in how to interview the patient, how to gather that information. They rely more on these tests and measures that they learned in PT school or residency training, and they put more emphasis on that rather than the actual conversation with the patient and then trying to verify or clarify information with the objective exam. And finally, a novice learner really uses much more closed-ended questions. They're a little bit more biased. They don't really deviate much from what their initial thought process. And in fact, they're really, really tied to rules like clinical prediction rules, algorithms, protocols. That is like the gospel truth to them. And again, that's not necessarily bad, but it's the over-reliance, that's the lack of putting context to the clinical encounter where a novice clinician really struggles. In contrast to that, expert clinical reasoners do just a little bit of the opposite. Although they do spend some time in that backward reasoning when there's new and novel patient presentations before them, because of their more multidimensional knowledge base, they have a little bit better enhanced recall, they have better clinical pattern recognition. So some of their thinking can happen much more quickly. And so they actually spend less time in the test and measures portion because they don't have to do every test and measure to verify the information. They're better, much more adept at questioning skills. They're better at gathering the information, verifying the information, and forming those hypotheses and recognizing clinical patterns so that when they do the tests and measures, they're only doing a couple of different things rather than trying to prove 4, 5, 6 different clinical hypotheses. And in contrast to novice clinical reasoners, experts spend a little bit more time doing open-ended questions, a funneling technique, which Stephanie and I talk about in a conference. And what's really a stark difference between a novice and an expert is their clinical reasoning really never stops. It continues not only through the interview and the exam, but into the intervention. And they actually use the intervention as a form of evaluation and approving a hypothesis or ruling it out. And so those are the key aspects that we found in the literature between novice and expert clinical reasoners. What Stephanie and I are trying to do and what we present in the conference is how can we move that learner faster out of that novice stage and into the more proficient and competent stages and hopefully get them better ready for residency and fellowship level training.
I certainly could not have explained that in the same eloquent way that you did, but if I can put a few words in your mouth, you basically just said, this is exactly what Steve's been through in his career.
Well, that I think we can all say that, Steve. that was the revelation to me. You know, when I went to my fellowship training, I was probably had been practicing about eight or nine years. I thought I was a pretty good physical therapist, which I probably was. I didn't hurt my patients for sure. I got the majority of them better. But when I entered into my fellowship level training, I saw that the lack of my very structured, systematic way of taking a history, of really understanding clinical reasoning, was severely lacking. And so what we've tried to take is that process that we learned in our fellowship level training, can I move it down a little bit better to the novice stage and entry level or residency level to speed this process up? Because what we're talking about is a structure, is a concept, is a method. And so that's what Stephanie and I have been doing for the last 4 years at the entry level. And we're just excited to see some of this process. Now, we still have to gather more data and test these hypotheses, but we're excited about it because we see even year one, semester one students making connections that a proficient and competent therapist would make. Now, that's not always consistent, but to have them make that connection so early on and then repeat those connections is really where we take the most joy in seeing our students learn and grow.
And Stephen, if I could add to that, as a CI, like I said before, I would see students come in and they would have these problems and have these errors that we talked about when they were doing evaluations and interventions. And I had, of course, exposure to the SENS concept, but I had never applied it in a systematic fashion like this before. And when I started to do that a little bit later in my career, I realized, you know, I would think back to the students that I had and I would realize where their errors were coming from. And I would understand that if they had been able to implement this process and had this structure, that they probably wouldn't have been making these errors that I was seeing over and over again. And so that's really what drove me to become a part of this with Evan, was seeing the difference it made in my own clinical reasoning ability, really being able to put a structure and a reliable framework into what was in my head. And that just really decreased the amount of errors, and I could really figure out where I was going wrong in different places.
I really like the sound of that. And if you could just give us a few examples, what are those common errors that you see when either it's you as a more experienced clinician or say an entry-level student, where are we going wrong when we don't use or rely upon a systematic approach?
Back in the 2018 conference, we presented the most common clinical reasoning errors, and that was really based on quite an extensive review of the literature. We've added to this over time, but really it boils down to one, ineffective gathering and verification of information that then guides this clinical reasoning. Two is a failure to filter and group these signs and symptoms into meaningful and manageable chunks of information. And the literature calls that chunking. So it's putting that information into groups that you can really think about as a whole. Third is deficits in knowledge, and that could be either analytical or experiential. Fourth is letting personal and professional biases cloud our reasoning process. And then fifth is an over-reliance on heuristics or cognitive strategies or mental shortcuts. And so this is what we presented back in 2018. And at this conference, we tried to take that to the next level. We really tried to present strategies for how to overcome these types of errors, the most common types of errors. We got into a little bit about how these come about and then what we need to do to avoid them to help our learners move faster from that novice to expert practice.
Let's dive into that a little bit further, because that's really the bulk of what we are, or maybe what we should be talking about today. How can we go from, to use the part of the title of your presentation, from a novice to expert in no time? Because as I alluded to before, maybe I'm going to go a little bit deeper into it now. When Evan was giving us that description, I was, yes, seeing a reflection of my career in there. All of the, let's be honest, years and more than one post-professional program that it took me to feel like, wow, I've actually kind of made it. I've had enough mentoring. I've gone to class enough. I've seen enough patients. I feel like I might be at this point an expert. And how is it that we make that a shorter, quicker, easier process?
That's a great question, Stephen. Let me answer your question with a question a little bit. And this is by no means a way to be critical of anybody's education, but it's interesting how much very systematic thinking or systematic way in thinking about your thinking was introduced at that entry level. In your entry level education, were you taught how to think? Were you taught how to reason? Did you have time to reflect on that reasoning? Did you have opportunities to weigh the information that you were gathering in a way that helped you understand why you were doing things rather than just the what in what you were doing?
That is an absolutely excellent question. And I have tortured myself with what the answer to that question might be. And I honestly have no recollection. I would love to have a time machine and go back to my entry-level education. But I remember when I was at the university doing my fellowship, for example, that I initially felt kind of robbed by what I thought I hadn't been exposed to earlier. But it was all such a blur because PT school is so difficult that, right, you know, I don't want to represent what I did or didn't get exposed to. And I just love to go back and see it all so I could understand the answer to your question.
Absolutely agree. And I've just been really privileged to not only teach at the different levels, but also interact with clinicians like Stephanie and some others of our in our school, that as we start to teach some of these concepts in literally, I teach year one entry-level education or PT school. And what we're finding is introducing some of these more systematic and structured processes that the students' minds start to become better prepared for the information that we're giving them. And what's interesting, as we co-teach together, you start hearing some of these things like, oh, I've never thought of it that way. Or, you know, this is a very novel way to teach what has been taught maybe in other programs in ways that are still good. But what if we could make it a little bit more transparent, the actual clinical reasoning? Because really, in essence, it's all clinical reasoning. Whether you talk about it, I mean, it's the things that we do. But underlying all of that is, how do I take a history? Why do I ask this question before that question? How do I effectively rule out non-musculoskeletal conditions and make sure that the patient sitting in front of me is truly appropriate for physical therapy care? And then how do I know, or how do I verify that what I've decided to do for this person is consistent with not only their condition, but also all the contextual factors that is connected to that patient themselves? And I think as we understand those concepts better or earlier in the learning process, I think those things are going to make much more sense. And we can, again, progress the learner faster out of that novice stage and start to really adopt practice patterns and learning strategies that are more consistent with the advanced beginner, proficient level practitioner, that type of thing. I think the other thing that Stephanie and I have talked long and hard about before we even started putting this presentation together was, we definitely believe that the development of clinical reasoning as a core ability really does require lifelong learning. So I don't think we should be ashamed that we had to go through PT school, we had to go through residency fellowship. I think that's still an important aspect. But what if we could speed up the process, that we don't spend so much time in that more novice stage? For example, why was I, in essence, a more novice thinker even when I was getting to the point of my fellowship level training? And so that's what Stephanie and I are trying to do at that entry-level education, is employ some of these strategies. And we're happy to talk about those next if you'd like to.
I think that would be a great place to take the conversation. And I guess that's going to move us towards, how are you implementing all of this to try and speed things up?
Yeah, that's great. Great. So let's go back to the one that Stephanie mentioned, the five main, as we did the literature review on the five most common clinical reasoning errors. The very first one is ineffective gathering and verification of pertinent information to guide that clinical reasoning process. So we really feel that if the student is not actually gathering that information in a very systematic, structured way, their clinical reasoning process is going to be flawed, because they're going to make these jumps within the patient interview that inherently will start to introduce errors into their clinical reasoning. And the second positive thing about this process is, at the same time we're teaching them how to gather the information effectively, the way we have it structured is they're able to then filter that information or group it in ways that they can make decisions much more effectively. So that, again, like Stephanie said, that's called chunking in the literature, where I can put the pieces of information that the patient tells me in ways that I can process it and weigh it a little bit more effectively. But I've seen this so often in the classroom and in the clinic, where students just start gathering the information, but they don't know why they're doing it. It's just, they're just writing down a bunch of information. And as long as I fill in words and all these parts of the evaluation, I'll be fine. And then when they turn to me and I say to them, so tell me what's going on with the patient. They look at me, well, I don't know yet. I haven't got to my test and measure section yet. I said, but you've just been talking to the patient for 15 minutes. And so you have a lot of information to gather this from. And you can really rule out or rule in certain things just based on a very, very well performed interview. So that's basically what one of the first things we ever teach. In fact, this is information we teach them day one of PT school about these clinical reasoning errors, the clinical reasoning process, and how we are going to do this very systematic approach. In fact, we have a joke. Stephanie and I, again, have been teaching together for about 4 years or so. And I think during about the second class period, we start introducing the word systematic and structured and things like this. And then I joke with them, I say in class, I said, guys, come up with antonyms or the opposite of systematic and tell me what you get. And so I give them a minute or so to think about those. And the students do really well with this. They come up with random, chaotic, haphazard, so beautiful antonyms for systematic. And I said, you're absolutely right. So I'm about to do a random, haphazard, chaotic evaluation on you. Would that be okay with you? And of course, they all laugh and, oh, we don't want that, Dr. Peterson. I said, well, here's why we're teaching this, because we don't want you to do it either. But because of our experience, we've seen very haphazard, somewhat random, chaotic evaluations over and over and over. And it's no wonder why students and other clinicians are struggling with their patients when they don't truly understand them. And so this is why we teach these very structured, systematic ways to take it. There's an actual order to how we ask questions, and there's an order to how we do the medical screening. There's even an order to our medical screening form that will actually help the novice clinician start to chunk the information in ways that he or she can make more informed decision. So that's just one example of how that structure and systematic process that we teach is actually combating those first two clinical reasoning errors. But going back to your previous point, though, this is where I think some of this breaks down in our ability to move the learner faster. For example, Stephanie said deficits in analytical and experiential knowledge is definitely one of the areas where a learner can make clinical reasoning errors. That's where we're not very good at. How do we speed that process up? Because they just need experience, right? So we try to do this at the University of Incarnate Word and at Bowling Green in basically having the students do early clinical immersion. So in the first year of PT school, they're already going to our pro bono clinic and spending time in that. We have patient days where actual patients come to the classroom and they experience what it's like to interact with a real patient rather than more of a paper-based case. And then, of course, our overlying thing, especially during year one, is more of this paper-based case where they have clinical scenarios. But the way we write these clinical cases is that there's not just one right answer. There's a variety of answers that you can go down to really test your clinical reasoning. Now, of course, you still need to be on the ballpark, but the way we've written these is it really forces them to clinically reason and weigh the alternatives, you know, this finding versus that finding, and make decisions that are based on sound clinical reasoning rather than just a best educated guess or back on that clinical prediction rule algorithm or something along those lines.
My follow-up to that is what we might potentially label as an unfair question, because I think I'm asking for an unreasonable awareness of the entirety of how we're teaching an entry-level physiotherapy. But do you have any appreciation for how well we're doing right now with teaching clinical reasoning? And part of what I'm getting at here is it's great if you're seeing, you know, these nice results at the universities you're teaching at. But, you know, maybe we need to know more about how other programs are doing. And I guess part of that is always just trying to understand, how are we doing right now? How much can we improve? And what do we need to do to improve our approaches to education?
Well, Stephen, as part of developing this program at Bowling Green State University, I've really been looking at a lot of different programs. I've been looking at how they teach clinical reasoning as best as I can from a distance. But I see that a lot of programs are really trying to integrate this throughout their program. I think where we can do a better job is really starting it early. I think sometimes the perception is that this is a higher level or higher order thinking, and so that it needs to be later in the program or even at the end of the program, residency, fellowship level. And from my perspective, this is something that we absolutely have to do in entry-level education. We're graduating physical therapists. You know, it's not like they have to go into residency or fellowship in order to treat patients. They're already treating patients. And so we really need to give them that framework and give it to them early on. Like Evan said, this is something that we've been doing day one of PT school. And we try to just progress it throughout the entire program to really help our students develop this framework of clinical reasoning. And so our graduates are treating patients. And so if they don't have this framework, then we're really setting them up for failure, because that will lead to these errors that we've talked about. I've also had the privilege of working with FSBPT on the national licensing exam. And as I look at the questions, you know, just the type of questions in the exam, it's all clinical reasoning, all of it, regardless of setting, regardless of the type of issue the patient is having, it's all clinical reasoning. Yes, they have to have the knowledge. They have to understand the anatomy, the tests and measures, the disease processes, but they have to be able to reason through and apply this knowledge in the clinical setting while reducing their errors to be successful. So teaching our students how to systematically perform clinical reasoning really sets them up for success on the NPTE, as well as setting them up for success in evaluating and treating their patients.
That all makes complete sense to me, and I, of course, agree that clinical reasoning is of paramount importance. Speaking of which, we've been, of course, discussing entry-level education mostly, because you were both educators within entry-level institutions. But what about the clinicians that are already out there in clinics that are working with patients? Let's say they, for example, feel like their clinical reasoning isn't quite up to par. What type of advice would you have for them if they want to develop better clinical reasoning skills?
That's a great question, Stephen. I think this is what the real joy of this is, or the power, I guess, maybe is a better word of these, is that they can be applied at any level. And so if you as a clinician are struggling with your patients, either as a whole or just individual patients, we would encourage you to reflect on your current practice and how you're doing this and weigh it against some of these strategies that we're talking about, and see if some of those errors have not crept in to your processes of being a clinician, of evaluating your patients. We would contend that that's probably where those errors are coming from and why you're struggling so much with that. So just really quickly, we'll just briefly identify the five things that we talk about in the conference. Is number one, that specific sequence when taking a patient's history. So if you're that type of clinician that really allows the patient to do the talking in a way that the information comes out in a very random, kind of haphazard way, and you're just trying to record it and take it in, I would contend that that is a very inefficient way to evaluate or conduct the patient history. Now, this is not putting words into the patient's mouth, but instead guiding the patient through a very logical process, a step-by-step process, to gather the information in a way that not only the patient can tell their story better, but then you as a clinician can hear their story better. Actually, that collaboration is really at the core of what a clinical reasoning is. And if we forget about the patient, we forget about their contextual factors, we're really focused more on it's a clinician-centered evaluation. It's not a patient-centered evaluation. So this process that we teach is this very sequential. There's a reason why this part comes before this part, is so that you can put it into context with the rest of the stuff. The second thing we really stress is the symptom map. This is another area that Stephanie and I feel very passionate about, and there's been plenty of stuff published on this, but how it's used, I think, is still kind of lacking. We all agree that a symptom map is good, but how do I actually take one that's really comprehensive? And when do I take it, right? Is it important to take it before or after certain parts? Do I just rely on the patient's own report of it, or can I guide the patient through that very systematic symptom mapping so that I truly understand as a clinician where the patient's pain is and where it's not, and more importantly, what the quality and the quantity of the pain is. Because if we truly are wanting to be pain scientists, like our profession is moving into, if I don't understand the patient's pain and put it into context of who they are and what they're doing, I would contend that, again, this is more clinician-centered, not patient-centered. The SINS concept that we mentioned earlier is also one that's just, it flows in and around what we do. We really help the students identify these things because if they're taking a very well-structured history, they're going to gather the information that they need to be able to identify the patient's SINS effectively. So in other words, the patient's symptom severity, their symptom irritability, the nature of not only the condition, but the nature of the patient, and then what stage and the stability of the condition is in. Even when a novice learner understands that, it's almost like the light bulb comes on and they see the patient as a whole rather than seeing them as this is a person with a knee problem, right? It's not only just a person with a knee problem. It's a person with a knee problem whose job's been affected, whose lifestyle's been affected, who may or may not buy into the things that we're telling them to do. And so really understanding that patient as a whole, I think, is what the power of this process is. And then the last thing we utilize is really clinical reasoning tools that will make the learner's reasoning visible. And that is found in several places in the literature, and I could not agree more with it. I was definitely not doing this at the entry-level stage and into residency type of training. I definitely don't think I was doing that very well. And it wasn't until I was in the fellowship level where I had to put down my reasoning. Why did I do this? What was the purpose behind this? Give me the reasons why or why not this decision was made. Until I was, quote unquote, forced to do that, I really didn't reflect on it too effectively. And so what we've done is actually take that process from what I learned in fellowship level training into the entry level and are actually using these tools. They've just been modified for use in entry level to help the learners really put their thinking on paper to make it more visible and transparent. And there was actually two analyses that were published just last year and this year, Huhn et al. In 2019 and Oostendorp et al. In 2020 published these clinical reasoning analyses. And in them, they really called for this more transparent way to see and to measure how we do clinical reasoning. And I would highly recommend those two articles for those of you who don't know them. They were recently published again in 2019 and 2020 in the Journal of Physical Therapy. But they really call for these things, these tools, these strategies to make clinical reasoning more visible. So that's what Stephanie and I are trying to do, is to put those things in action because we're at that level where we can make the learner start to develop these habits and skills that will help them throughout their careers as physical therapists.
We can certainly make sure that we link to those papers that you just mentioned so that any one of our listeners who wants to look them up can easily find a link in the show notes. And as we start to get ready here to close out our conversation, one of the burning questions I have for both of you is, yes, of course, it sounds like you think that we can make this educational process more effective and efficient, but you've also said that it's a lifelong learning process. So how important do you think that whole post-professional educational path is for people? And is that something that clinicians you think should do or maybe should do? Just in general, what's your opinion on that?
Of course, I'm probably going to be a little biased because I did go through that process. And so I would say I would recommend it for others. Our hope is that we prepare the clinician or the student better for that experience. And that's, we're not trying to replace it by any means. In fact, I would highly recommend residency and fellowship level training because of that additional experiential and analytical knowledge base that you're going to gain from that type of experience where you probably don't have time to get it at there. And plus, you know, residency and fellowship level are typically more specialized, right? They're not as generalized as entry-level education is, and that's what they're for. And so, you know, where we don't have time to go into depth into pediatrics or women's health or sports or ortho as specifically as we'd like to in entry-level education, that's really where this residency and fellowship will shine. But what if I can make that learner who applies for that residency program and fellowship program better prepared as a learner so they're not having to overcome some of these errors in clinical reasoning? They're just applying some of these strategies at that higher level to gain faster that experience, put it into practice, be a better clinician, rather than spending the first part of their residency or fellowship level training either relearning how to think or for the first time learning how to think and putting these strategies in play. So that's basically our hope. We've benefited from them as clinicians. My hope is that we can just make the learner much better prepared for that residency and fellowship level training.
Stephen, I'd also like to add there that, you know, we look at post-professional residency and fellowship training and how it affects our ability to treat our patients, to provide more effective interventions for our patients. And really, this is no different. It's not like showing these intervention techniques in entry-level education means that you don't need that extra practice, that extra mentorship. And so when we talk about implementing these clinical reasoning strategies and education in entry-level education, it's really just a starting point. And yes, I fully believe that that starting point should be day one of PT school, entry-level PT school. But I completely agree with Evan that it should just continue. The more mentorship that our clinicians get in residency and fellowship training, the better they will be. And this is a continuum of the process. We have these clinical reasoning errors that occur, and the more training we get, it's just a better way to reduce these errors. But I completely agree that this does not replace residency or fellowship training. It just starts them a little bit further along in the process, hopefully, and allows them to continue and just get better and better.
I think that all sounds like a very healthy and wise way to contextualize our physical therapy education processes. And again, biases being pointed out, I am a fellow of the Academy myself. I could not imagine my career without them, but I, of course, also want to see entry-level education be as effective and efficient as possible. So I couldn't agree more with the things that were just said. And quite frankly, it's been a distinct pleasure having both of you on the podcast today. I think this is a very important topic that doesn't get enough attention sometimes in the peer-reviewed literature and other places within the profession. So thank you for bringing this content and your knowledge and experience to our podcast.
Thank you, Stephen. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
This has been a production of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. You can learn more about the Academy by visiting our website at aaompt.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for our acronym, AAOMPT. The views and opinions expressed on the AOMPT podcast are those of the interviewers and interviewees and do not represent the official position of AOMPT. The information presented should not be used as personal health care or clinical practice advice. If you need to find an expert orthopedic physical therapist near you, then check out the Find a Fellow feature under the Public Resources tab at www.aaompt.org, which you can find in the show notes.